Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 13th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Unholy Ground, Pollution Problems at the Holden Mine, presented by Rick Dunning in the Fireside Room. Let's listen in.
Welcome you. My name is Rick Dunning. I'm the curator of Holden's Museum and have done that for a number of years now. And this afternoon I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the issues related to the mine and the pollution problems associated with that. And so what I'd like to do is talk about how the problem came to be and what's been done so far and what remains to be done in the future. And if it's all right, I'll just work from back here where I've got control of the mouse or the pointer. So we're used to thinking of this pristine wilderness around us and this holy ground that we call Holden and all of the beauty, but in the midst of that beauty we have this old mine and this these big piles of rock left behind. And certainly there could be no Holden Village without this mine, because the town wouldn't be here for us to make use of. So we owe our existence to this mining operation, but it also creates some problems for us and for the larger ecosystem. And those are the problems I'd like to talk about a little bit today. So we're up here in Railroad Creek, and the village is across the creek from the mine site. And this is a shot of the mine site when it was in operation. Let me just kind of point out a few things here. This is very early in the history of the mine. There isn't much in the way of tailings piles yet. But the ore was discovered high on the mountainside by James Henry Holden in 1896. Took a number of decades before anything was put into production, and by then Holden himself was dead and the mine was out of the family. But Holden's original diggings are up in this part of Copper Mountain, up high on the mountainside. The company that developed the Holden Mine was called the Howe Sound Mining Company. Their first mine was on the Howe Sound of British Columbia on the coast north of Vancouver. That's where they had their name. And they came in 1928 to begin planning the mine. They discovered that the ore is in a layer of rock that's kind of, the edge of it goes down the mountainside kind of like this, but the rock just from the point where Holden discovered it just is a layer that goes straight down across the front of the mountain. And when they found that out, they decided not to start up at the top where Holden found the ore sticking out, but their tunnel goes in down here, lower on the mountainside. And their main entrance, their portal is here, and then their tunnel goes half a mile into the mountain before it hits that vertical layer of rock. And they mined upward above the tunnel first, got all the ore above the tunnel by 1945, and then they went down below the tunnel and mined below the tunnel. So from top to bottom, the mine is over half a mile from side to side. It's about half a mile wide, and that ore layer was about 80 feet thick. It was a low-grade ore. It was only about 2% valuable metal. So they couldn't just ship it out to be processed. They had to do some pre-processing here. And that was the function of the mill building. The ore coming out of the mountain was taken into the top of the mill building, and it went down through a series of crushing machines that eventually ground the rock up into fine powder. And by the time the ore got to the bottom of the mill, it went into flotation tanks to chemically separate out the good stuff. Yeah, question.
There was never actually a refinery, though, is that right?
No. This was a concentrating mill, so they would take the original ore, which had about 2% valuable metal to it, and they would concentrate it up to about 40%. So what they're trying to do is get rid of as much of the waste rock as they can in this concentrating process. So they used chemicals that would stick to the valuable minerals and make those float to the surface in their flotation tanks. So they skim the good stuff off the top. And the waste rock is in the bottom of the tank still as a slurry of rock and water. And after they go through several of these flotation tanks, several circuits of it, to get as much of the valuable metals out as they can, then the good stuff is dewatered a little bit, so you've got kind of a wet, pasty powder. That's loaded onto the trucks, and it's shipped down to the lake and out and goes eventually by rail to Tacoma, Washington, where the smelter was. That's the final refining, the final purifying is in the smelter.
Is it ASARCO?
ASARCO smelter, yeah.
So, I know you're going to kind of get to like the adverse effects of the tailing, but if they were using all these chemicals and stuff at that time, they had like some settling ponds or something too, or were they just dumping that into the creek?
Well, a lot of the chemicals that were sticking to the valuable metal went out with it, and that was still attached when they sent it out. They were certainly using some other chemicals, including a little bit of cyanide, to suppress other metals in the flotation process that they didn't want coming up. So those would have been part of that slurry of tailings that then went from the mill down into ponds, settling ponds down here. They piped the tailings down the valley into these settling ponds coming right out of the flotation tanks. And then the rock would settle out, and then you would get the water drained off into another settling pond for a while. And then into Railroad Creek.
When the concentrated stuff went out, was it all, there were after four metals mainly?
Yeah.
And they were all mixed together when
they Right, in this ore, it's a mixture of many metals. Mm-hmm. Iron-bearing minerals and copper and zinc and gold and silver and lead and cadmium and some other trace metals. They just went after the copper primarily, plus gold, silver, and zinc. Those were the four products. So in terms of the value of the production, about 70% of it was copper, about 21% gold.
So the road off to the right that winds up the hill there, that goes up to Honeymoon Heights?
This would go up to Honeymoon Heights, which are some higher access tunnels. But the original mining camp was called Honeymoon Heights, and that would have been about here on the mountainside. Mm-hmm. Holden's original cabin was up there, and some of the early bunkhouses and stuff were up there. And as I say, Holden's original tunnels were up higher on the mountainside. So that's the basic layout. To be able to put the tailings down here, they had to get Railroad Creek out of the way. So they had to create an artificial channel for Railroad Creek, and with cribbing along the side of it to hold it in place. And they diverted Railroad Creek into that artificial channel, which essentially is where it is now. So essentially they're shoving it over to this side of the valley to make as much room on the valley bottom as they can for those tailings
ponds. So it originally was closer to the mountain?
Well, it was a meandering creek in this section of the valley, just winding back and forth across the valley bottom. And they wanted this space to put their tailings in. So this is a simplified view of the mountain. The upper half especially is too oversimplified, but this is the ore layer dipping down from the surface. They'd blast the rock out of there, and they'd send it up to the main tunnel. Goes out through the crushing machines of the mill building, down into the flotation tanks for separation, into the drying bins to dewater it, and then into the trucks to send it on down lake.
According to that last chart, it said that zinc was listed in tons, gold was listed in ounces, and but gold accounted for 20% of the...
The value of gold was so much higher.
Sure.
It was running... The copper was about 2% of the rock, so about 40 pounds per ton. So zinc was about 5 pounds per ton. Silver was about a third of an ounce per ton, and gold was about a tenth of an ounce per ton of rock. And the mill processed 2,000 tons of rock a day, ground up 2,000 tons a day. So this was kind of what we're left with after the fact. So we've got, again, this is the mill site here, although the mill is mostly torn down. After the mine closed, the salvage company came in and tore out lots of metal and machinery in this site, got rid of a lot of that. the higher piles either side of the mill are really just rocks that were blasted out during the tunneling process. They're just waste products, nothing processed there.
It's not tailings?
Not in the sense that it's been through the mill.
Oh, okay.
They did high grade a little bit, so they dumped some ore in this first pile in case they needed it, some of the lower grade ore. And so they processed the higher grade stuff first. This is that Honeymoon Heights Trail, and it crosses some of these ore dumps from the higher access tunnels. And then these are the tailings piles. So pile one is on the west side of Copper Creek, pile two and pile three. Pile two is the higher one here on the east side of Copper Creek, and then they had just started pile three. It's much lower than the other two. And that was where they ended. About 90 acres of the valley bottom are covered with those tailings. Again, that's the waste rock with the good stuff taken out. But it's all ground up into powder, all pulverized into powder in the mill building. So you get that visual sense of how much they took out of the mountain from looking at those piles. And then, of course, the village is right here. Copper Creek comes down between the piles. Railroad Creek is going along this edge of the piles.
So what's the stability of the internal mine where all this has been extracted from?
Well, the rock is very hard in there. Most of that rock is harder than steel. And the mine, as best we can tell from limited access, is all open inside, except that the lower half is flooded. So it's full of water up to the main tunnel, and that water drains out of the portal.
Is that pretty contaminated then?
It is contaminated from being in contact with the ore. Yeah.
I'm sure that's part of the remediation consideration also, not just the tailings, but the water.
Absolutely, yep. And we'll cover that a little bit more, but it is part of the issue. So this is how it looked 15 years ago about. Big orange piles, the wreckage of the mill building. There are some bins of ore in here that still have ore in them. When they shut down, they just turned off the switches and walked away, so they didn't finish processing what they had.
So what gives the tailing piles this kind of orangish-brown color?
It's the iron still in there that's rusting. Okay. Now, the original color of the tailings is black. And if you dig down just a couple feet, you get back into the black tailings, but the surface is oxidized. So, again, this is what they mainly look like. This is early spring, so there's a little water ponding up there, but that soaks through pretty fast because this is the texture of very fine sand, so it's the water moves through it fairly easily. It's a very dry environment, therefore, and it's also... The other thing about these tailings, they're all sulfide minerals, so there's sulfur in the ore, and that makes the tailings acidic as well. And so nothing grew on the tailings piles for three decades after the mine had shut down, so they were just these bare piles. And this was one of our biggest problems. On windy days, this is what it would look like. That fine dust would start to blow around. We'd have big orange piles wafting down the valley. Sometimes it would blow into the village, of course, get in folks' eyes, and if you had breathing problems, it certainly was irritating that way.
Is that bad to inhale?
Well, you wouldn't want to inhale it long term. Short term is not a big deal, but there are no permanent residents here, so nobody's exposed to it all that long. But it isn't stuff you want to breathe long term. So that was the biggest issue that folks were worried about. In part, the fact that the piles were so ugly, these big orange piles in the middle of pristine wilderness, and the air pollution, the dust problem. Those were concerns that folks had. And the village has a long history of trying to wrestle with what to do with these tailings. There have been a lot of things proposed. I think one of the most popular is that you just give everybody a plastic bag and let them take some home and kind of spread it out across the country that way. I don't think that was ever instituted. For a while, the village sprinkled sewage effluent on the first pile. That provided both moisture and organic matter and got some trees started on the first pile. But course, now the health department doesn't allow you to sprinkle sewage effluent. For a while, the village experimented with growing Jerusalem artichokes on the piles. And they weren't going to eat the artichokes, but they wanted to distill them and use the alcohol as a fuel supplement for the vehicles. But the artichokes grew, but the still didn't work very well. That was a problem.
But that would still keep the dust down if you get
it. It would have still kept the dust down, yeah. If they could have done more of that. So there, as I say, a number of experiments. For a while, there was some consideration of even reprocessing the tailings. There's still a reasonable amount of gold left in there, and now the price of gold is much higher than it was the time the mine shut down. So there was some thought you could reprocess the gold and then dispose of the tailings a little more properly. That gold income might help pay the costs of proper disposal, but it turned out the gold content wasn't as high as folks hoped, so that experiment was.
Do you know roughly what percentage of the available gold they got out?
Well, in terms of all the metals, they were probably at about 85% efficiency.
But you don't know about gold specifically?
I don't know about gold specifically. Okay. Except that there are many millions of dollars there in those piles. Yeah. And it just would cost you many millions more to get it out. Also, you can see the cribbing was starting to rot out. So there was some concern that there might be erosion of the tailings piles directly into Railroad Creek as this stuff rotted away. So in 1989, the Forest Service initiated a remediation effort. And it really began in earnest in the summer of 1990. And basically what they did was cover the tailings with gravel. And so the gray color you see here is the gravel cover. It comes from a gravel pit down near the top of the switchbacks. And they just brought it in truckload at a time. It took them two summers, as I say, to get it all covered over. About 4 to 6 inch layer. They couldn't really cover the sides of the tailings because those are so steep. They draped some erosion control fabric down the edges to help a little bit. And they also created islands of topsoil. That's what we see here. And they planted vegetation in those islands of topsoil, hoping that eventually the vegetation would spread out across the whole piles and they would gradually blend in visually with the rest of the forest. So that was their effort in 90 and 91. In addition to that, they also put some riprap along the base of the tailings piles to protect them from erosion. And they created some diversion channels on the uphill side to divert water around the piles because they were concerned about pollution of the creek from water that seeped through the tailings. And so they tried to build diversion channels both around it and on top of the piles so that water would flow around the tailings instead of through the tailings.
That's what you see coming out of the portal. And then there's a plastic-lined stream that goes alongside the road.
That was specifically for the portal, but they did a similar thing around the top of the piles as well. So you can see here, this is a kind of a mid-90s photo, so you can certainly see vegetation growing in those islands. It became a Forest Service experiment station, essentially. They tried a variety of combinations of plants here to see which would grow best. Some they irrigated, some they didn't irrigate, some they fertilized, some they didn't fertilize, just trying lots of different things to see what would grow best in the tailings. And those efforts have been relatively successful. Now these bigger trees here down at the lower left, those are the ones that grew when the village was sprinkling sewage effluent there. So they're fairly well established. But the rest of the vegetation here is from the Forest Service remediation effort. The other thing they did was to try and create some fish habitat. They put some boulders in the creek to try and create pools to generate more fish habitat in there. This is a closer look at some of the debris they brought in to help provide organic matter. And so in addition to the topsoil, they brought some of this kind of slash material in and covered it over. You can see one of the drainage channels along the top of the pile here. Again, that was to divert some of that snow melt water off the pile before it had a chance to soak in.
And that's lined with plastic then?
No, those were just lined with bigger boulders. Okay. Some of the uphill ones were lined with some erosion control fabric. So you can see a little bit of the vegetation regrowth. It was relatively successful. There are volunteer plants coming in the gravel, lupin and alder and other things they didn't plant that are just naturally moving into that gravel cover, and the piles now are much more significantly vegetated than they were a decade ago. So they've had some success in that. And the gravel cover has definitely eliminated the dust problem, really cut down on air pollution problems dramatically. This is some of that diversion channel. And this is down where they put some of the riprap. And you can see the boulders in the stream to provide some trout habitat.
So how does the pH of the stream compare to the streams nearby?
It's really not too different most of the time. Water coming out of the portal and water that seeps out of the tailings is definitely more acidic. But it dilutes pretty quickly in the stream.
So it's not enough to affect the fish?
No, not dramatically. But what happened after this, there are a couple of different things. One, after about 5 years, there was some curiosity about whether they'd done enough. So they initiated a period of phase of environmental sampling, a rather extensive phase, testing air pollution, testing soil, testing vegetation, testing water pollution on the surface, water pollution in the groundwater, testing trout populations, insect populations in the streams. They had scuba divers in the stream trying to count trout and things like that. Sampling down in Lake Chelan, sampling sediments in Lake Chelan, just trying to do a very thorough environmental analysis over a period of several years to try and figure out if there was still a problem here. And essentially what they found out is that the biggest problem still remaining is the water pollution problem. That there are times during the year where Railroad Creek exceeds both state and federal water pollution guidelines. And there are a couple times kinds of pollution going on. One is the acidity. Though any water that's been in contact with the ore has been in contact with the sulfur in the ore, and so it's going to be mildly acidic like acid rain. But then that acid water also has the greater ability to dissolve metals out of the ore, and those heavy metals are carried into the stream, and that's really the significant pollution problem. Those heavy metals are killing off the insects, and without the insects, the trout don't have as much of a food base to work from. And so what you get is a diminished population of insects and trout downstream from the tailings piles, or 4 or 5 miles downstream from the tailings. So most of the problems were solved with this effort in 90 and 91, but the water pollution wasn't. And the other thing they found out of special significance was that the water draining out of the mine portal is as much a source of pollution as what comes out of the tailings. That the pollution loadings from the portal are as great as the pollution loadings from the tailings piles. Because again, as the water filters down through the old mine workings, it's coming in contact with what's left of the ore that's been oxidized by the air flowing through it. And so it dissolves those metals out of the mine just in the same way it dissolves them out of the tailings piles. And they're washed into the creek. And then you have the metals pollution there.
So the undisturbed rock is not porous enough to... I'm trying to think of what it was like before the mine was here.
Well, certainly there have been water draining through it, and this kind of rock would be a source of metals loading to the stream under natural conditions.
Right.
And there are many outcrops of this kind of rock up the valley that are doing the same thing. It's just that in the mining process, they both in the tailings and in the mine itself, they've exposed so much more of the rock to oxygen and so much more of it to leaching that they just greatly accelerated the natural process.
So the oxygen is a major factor?
Yeah, the oxygen oxidizes, decomposes the ore, the metals, the minerals, and that makes them more mobile, more easily dissolved by the water then.
And the metals in the water kill the insects, you said?
Yeah, it's primarily a problem for the insect life. Now the biggest thing coming out of the tailings is iron. It comes out in a dissolved form, and then as soon as it hits the creek, it flocculates back into solid form and then just filters down onto the bottom. In fact, stretches of Railroad Creek downstream from the tailings, the whole bed of the stream is cemented solid with iron. And again, if you've got insects trying to live under rocks and the rocks are all cemented together, that's going to be harmful to them as well. So this is that portal drainage. In 90 and 91, the Forest Service tried lining the bed of the stream with limestone chunks to buffer the acidity and try and precipitate out the metals before it got into Railroad Creek, but that whatever they did wasn't enough to solve the problem. So there's continuous draining of the water out of there.
There's no natural limestone around here, is there?
No, there are a few little layers of marble through this part of the valley, but they're pretty small. You can really rely on them. So it drained on down out of the portal, down beside the road, and on into Railroad Creek eventually. This is the site of Pile 2 with their erosion control fabric. Here you can see the riprap boulders, and at water level you can see the orange color. Even in a matter of a few years, those rocks started turning orange from the iron that was coating them as that water seeped out of the tailings. This is sort of one of the natural seep areas from that water out of the tailings. So groundwater essentially is seeping through the piles. It bubbles up to the surface right here. You can see the discoloration of the ground and then into the creek and essentially turns the creek bed orange. That's a little closer look at it. So, Forest Service brought in more environmental scientists and geologists and ecologists and other agency folks to try and figure out what else to do. This is some more of that seepage area at the very far end of the tailings piles. You can see the discoloration of the soil surface. So just some analysis of what's going on here, trying to figure out what would be the next step. Here's some of that orange cementation in the stream bed. This is part of the trout population studies they were doing, some electroshocking as well as the scuba divers.
Is House Sound paying for cleanup, or are they still in business?
Well, that was the second big question. So they had two questions, and the second one was, who's going to pay for this? And of course the mine operated under the mining law of 1872, and they disposed of the tailings the way they were supposed to, or the way they were instructed to. So they essentially operated legally within their parameters of the day. But the legislation that comes into play here is called CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Liability or Compensation and Liability Act. And that's the legislation that created the Superfund. That's what it's most famous for. It's also, though, legislation that gave the federal government the ability to go after who made the mess. And it was originally applied to toxic waste sites, but it's come to be applied to lots of environmental problem sites. And that does give the federal government power to go after the folks that created the problem. But House Sound was bought out. They don't exist anymore. And then bought out again and bought out again. So it took them a while to try and figure out where the assets had ended up, who the natural successor was. And there's a metals company operating here in Washington called Intalco, but they're a subsidiary of a French company. So that's the company that eventually became the logical successor to House Sound. And eventually, the government was able to go to them and say, you need to pay for this cleanup. And they ultimately did sign an agreement that said, yes, we will do that. We'll pay for what's been done, all the gravel covered, and that sort of thing. We'll pay for all the monitoring effort, the environmental testing, and we'll pay for what has to be done in the future. So they have addressed this issue of who's going to pay for it as well. It's a company that, you know, it's a little odd because the company didn't run the mine. They weren't here. They didn't make the mess. But because they got House Sound's assets, they also got House Sound's liabilities in this matter. But they don't own the mine. Holden Village owns the mine.
Do you know how much money has been spent so far?
Well, the gravel cover, the work in 1991 was about $5 million worth. Probably there's been $10 million of environmental analysis so far. And then still the price tag on whatever they're going to do next, the remediation effort.
Isn't Holden Village leasing this, leasing the land?
Well, this town site where the buildings sit is land that's leased from the Forest Service. So we own the buildings, but not the land. But Holden does own the patented mine claims on the front side of Copper Mountain. Mm-hmm. So that's Holden Village private property where the mine is. And Holden Village owns the mineral rights of the mine. So technically they are the mine owners, and you would think logically that would make them a responsible party in this, and certainly they have been considered that. But of course what Holden doesn't have are deep pockets. And if you're going to pay for an environmental cleanup that's running in tens of millions of dollars, it's not going to come from a nonprofit organization. That's not hard to figure out. So they went looking for the corporate sources rather than the nonprofit sources. But it is an odd situation that way. Now, one of the other interesting questions that came up in this was because of the pollution coming out of the mine tunnel, there was some curiosity about what's going on inside the mine. How's water moving through there? How's air moving through there? What are the pollution sources inside the mine? So as part of the study, the remediation, the remedial investigation, the main portal was reopened. It had caved in the years since the mine had operated. So a mining company from Idaho was brought in to open up the mine tunnel. And so they had to get rid of the old portal. This is what a caved-in mine tunnel looks like.
Wow.
Those are the mine timbers that collapsed and caved in, and the roof caved in above that. So they had to take all that out of there to be able to... It's about the first 60 or 70 feet of the tunnel had caved in because it goes through these loose glacial sediments that you see here. Once it's back about 70 feet, then it's into bare rocked walls, and that was all still open. It's just the entrance they had to reopen. They rebuilt a new portal with some steel bracing, not just wood. And as I say, they were operating like a regular mining company. And so this was some of the equipment they used to haul stuff out. Still dealing with that collapsed stuff inside. Finally, they got it all opened up. And it was just a mess of water and fine muddy iron sediment and floating railroad ties and all kinds of stuff. So they drained the water out into a settling pond. It's not going into Railroad Creek. It went into a settling pond. And then they went in. And this is what it was like in the first efforts trying to slog in there. Through that
literally up like mud.
Well, it's referred to as slime, and that's really what it's like. It's very, very fine textured iron precipitate, really. So it's finer than clay, and just a soupy mud. See what it was like to get through that stuff.
I bet they loved that.
Yeah, I can tell they had a good time. But they did get that all cleared out and opened up, and so this is in the mine tunnel looking back at the portal. So this tunnel is almost half a mile in a straight line. This isn't all the way back in it, but even a half a mile in, you can look back and see the little opening that is the portal.
Have you been in?
I have had a chance to go in a couple times in these efforts. It's really nice. Really nice. These are high water marks, so you can tell where the water levels were in there. Some of the railroad ties that were floating out of there, the salvage company had taken out the railroad
tracks,
but they left the ties in there, and those just all floated out in the water. Mm-hmm. Now, because there's water constantly draining out, they put in new bulkheads, new dams to hold back the water inside. And so now to get into the mine, you've got to literally climb into these little boats and float back through the tunnel for 1,000 feet or so before it gets shallow enough to get out. So there are boats stored in the mine tunnel, and anytime you go in, you got to float your way in. That's too narrow to row, so you just got to pull yourself along the tunnel wall. Wow. But a lot of the stuff inside is still there. This is the main shaft. This is the elevator car that took the miners up and down, kind of laying on its side. But this was the vertical shaft. Water's bubbling up out of it constantly. But these signs show up in the original photographs from the mine when it was operating. They're still in there. This was the hoist room where the big winches were, the raise and lower the elevators. And we've got photos of this hoist room looking like this in the mining days as well. So it's fun to get back there and see some of the things you've just seen pictures of in the past.
Was this the first time it had been open since it was closed originally?
Yeah, it caved in probably about 20 years after it closed, in the mid-70s, and this was the first time people had been into this tunnel. So then once it was cleared out, then they went in to study the water, the pollution, the airflow through the mine, all those things. So they took lots of water samples and that sort of thing inside the mine. And so these are just some photos from those groups. They're dropping a water sampler down the shaft to get down into the deeper parts of the mine. And just some of those crews in action. One of the interesting things was a bat study. They were curious about whether bats were using the mine as an artificial cave. So biologists went in and looked around. The central question is whether you could seal off the mine or not, seal it off from airflow and water flow. But if bats were using it, then they didn't want it sealed off. So they had to kind of account for that.
And were there bats?
There, so far, no evidence of bats in there. But they put some infrared counters in there even, so that when they went away, they could pick up anything flying through the beam of the counter. So this is kind of how the portal looks today. They sort of reconstructed it a little bit like it looked originally, although it's a smaller structure. There's a pipe guiding the water out now in case anything else caved in, the water would still drain freely out of the tunnel.
So how bad was the internal water quality?
Well, it's got the same pollution problems. It's clear that one thing they have to do is set up a water treatment facility to treat the water coming out of the mine tunnel. And they thought for a while maybe they could inhibit the flow of air, inhibit the flow of water inside, and it doesn't look like that would work. So they just got to let it come out and treat it when it gets to the outside.
Now by they, it's Intelco, right?
Well, Intelco will have to pay for this water treatment plant and for essentially operating it into the future forever, essentially. At one point, that new tunnel caved in a little bit, so this is some of that. They had to do some repair then. There's lots of monitoring wells set up in the area to monitor groundwater quality, so this is some of the wells. They had to do some geological analysis, depth to bedrock and stuff like this. So these are some drillers working on some of the geologic questions. So there's been a lot of work here, just trying to figure out what the issues are. Sampling down in Lake Chelan again.
Have they found anything in Lake Chelan?
Well, there's some sediments at the mouth of Railroad Creek. But there's no polluted water showing up in Lake Chelan. What little pollution is coming from this mine is lost in the, diluted in the vastness of that lake volume. So no pollution shows up in the lake so far. except for the sediment right at the mouth. So again, we're back to this same photo we saw earlier of the current situation. And the next step in a process like that is to figure out what to do next, and it's called the feasibility study. And so the environmental consulting firm that's been doing this work came up with a list of options, 8 options and a bunch of sub-options. Option 1 was do nothing, and option 8 was a pretty complicated one involving piling all the tailings together and sealing them off totally. But the next step when they outline these options is then the agencies involved have to decide which option they think will solve the problem. And the agencies are the Forest Service, the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Washington State Department of Ecology. All of them eventually have to agree to what they think will be the best option for trying to deal with it. And then ultimately, Intalco has to agree to pay for it. And of course, Intalco's lobbying for one of the lower options that won't cost as much, and the agencies are sort of looking at one of the higher options that would cost quite a bit more, but they think would solve more of the problems. And so right now, we're in the midst of a big negotiation between those two groups as to what finally will be done here. And that's really where we're at right now. And they met a month ago and still didn't quite reach an agreement. So I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen next, except that it's fairly certain there will be a water treatment plant to handle the effluent out of the mine. And that'll go down here on the valley bottom somewhere. They're giving strong consideration, kind of in that flat area just downstream from the footbridge. They're giving strong consideration to some kind of passive treatment system, an artificial wetland that the water would flow through and the metals would settle out, and or they'd add some lime to change the pH and then precipitate out the metals in this artificial wetland, and the plants would help in that process of cleaning out the water. That would take less energy to operate than a conventional treatment plant and would probably fit in better to the system here. It's likely they'll put some kind of wall on the uphill side of all this. That's what the blue line is. A diversion wall to divert water around the tailings, around the site. So again, any water seeping down the mountainside won't get contaminated by going through the tailings.
But the wall would have to go down.
It would have to go to bedrock. But on the uphill side, that's not so much of a problem.
Okay.
You can get to bedrock pretty easily uphill.
The depth is up.
In most cases, it's right close to the surface, within feet of the surface, on that uphill side. They're probably going to have to do something with that old mill superstructure because of those ore bins that are still in there. They're going to have to do that. They're probably going to pave over the parking lot of the garage because there's some contaminated soil in there. There's some water seeping out of these higher ore dumps that comes down and empties into the Railroad Creek down about here. So they'll probably try and capture that seepage of water and get that into the treatment plant.
What's the red one there, yeah?
That's another open tunnel.
Mm. Open today?
Open now, open. Yeah. Except it's got locked bars across it.
Mm.
But it is, it has been open. The real question, and the reason the two groups aren't together yet, is the question of what to do about the tailing seepage. The agencies so far have wanted a wall here, this lime green feature. They want a wall on the downstream side of the tailings, between the tailings and Railroad Creek, that will prevent any water from seeping out of the tailings into the creek. And then they want that water to go into a treatment plant, a treatment facility down here. Originally, they wanted that wall to go all the way down to bedrock. So it would, but that's 80 feet deep in some places here. If you can imagine digging a trench 80 feet deep to get a wall down there, that's...
But if it doesn't, you're going to get significant...
Well, the thinking is that if you can get it down a reasonable distance, that's going to get most of it. It won't get absolutely everything, but it would get the largest percentage of it. Most of it would be fairly close to the surface. But this is what Intalco is balking on, because this system of capturing the tailings seepage will easily double the cost of the process. And they say, well, if the mine portal is 50% of the problem and we deal with that, then that should be enough. And they would prefer not to have to build this wall and worry about the tailings seepage. They may also have to cut back the edge of the tailings so they're not so steep and they're a little more stable. There's some concern that as time goes on and those become less stable, if you had an earthquake or something and shook those piles, they might spill down into the creek. So there may be some trimming back of the edge of the tailings a little bit. But this is the open question. Is that green line going to be there or not in the final decision?
So did they look at putting an impermeable layer on top of everything so that you...
No. Well, they talked about that. Certainly in the higher options, that was a consideration that maybe really you could cover them over. But they sort of drifted away from those, from that possibility. The expense. They're thinking water management rather than sealing it off. If they keep the water out of it with drainage systems, and that may be enough to cut down on how much water is inside it to seep out. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we're at. The basic situation. That most of these photos have come from this man, Norm Day. He's the Forest Service person in charge of this site. So he's the supervisor of this remediation. And this is one of the doorways in the side tunnel there in the mine. It's kind of fun.
How is Holden Village involved in what's happening now? They have people just observing.
Yeah, the Holden is present at these meetings, and we've got legal representation as well as administrative representation at these meetings. One of the criteria for the ultimate choice of options is that Holden has to survive. They want to ensure that Holden will be here and keep going, which is good for us, that we matter enough to make it through this process. But there's some concern about what effect this will have on life in the village during the short term. If you've got a big construction project going on over there and lots of heavy equipment, is that going to make it so noisy here that we really can't function the way we're used to functioning? So Holden will probably be involved in providing housing to folks that work on it. And some search they do now for the folks that come up to do all the environmental analysis. Holden may be involved in running the water treatment facility if it gets to that point. Certainly we will cooperate with what happens here, but we're also trying to look out for our interest and for the long-term health of the village as well. It's an interesting process, certainly interesting to watch what's happened so far and watch all these agencies trying to agree with each other and all that sort of thing.
So why has it taken so long? The village has been here for more than 40 years.
Yeah.
Did it take, was there a long span of time when nothing was done?
A long time. Well,
when we thought about it?
I mean, the village has always lobbied to try and have something done here. I mean, we've got copies of letters to Congress people and legislatures and agencies, and we've got the various experiments through the years, but really nothing done here in any significant way until 90 and 91.
So you're talking about a lot of this responsibility being put on Intalco. Is there governmental funds for like Superfund sites that are being talked about being used in this process too, though?
Not in this process. This site doesn't rank as a high enough priority to merit Superfund money. Each state sets their priority list. What are their worst places?
Hanford.
Hanford and some of the Intalco stuff, or uh, I didn't talk about the Asarco stuff over in Tacoma. There are bigger problems than here. So when the Forest Service did their gravel cover, they were able to draw on a fund that was strictly in the Forest Service for environmental issues. But then they've gone back to Intakwa to say, can you repay us for what we did? And they'll do that for most of it. But it was that piece of legislation that really made it possible to think about spending this much money and going and having a source for this money to address the problem.
And that was passed in the 70s?
I want to say 80s, early 80s, like 1980 maybe.
Now there must be a huge number of similar sites throughout the
West. Oh yeah, there are lots of mine sites in the West, and many of them are much worse than this one. And in the grand scheme of things, this isn't the worst mine site in the West by any shot. But it does sit above Lake Chelan, and in Washington that matters. That's sort of one of the crown jewels of the state, and they want to do everything they can to try and protect Lake Chelan from any possible damage.
Is the situation pretty similar, and the remediation plans pretty similar with other sites?
Yeah, lots, and similar issues. This acidic metallic drainage is very common in mines, and that's so they're dealing with similar problems.
Does Intelco have the right to go in and remine if there's still some viability with that?
Because Holden owns the mineral rights, not Intelco.
Have we ever thought about that?
Mining companies have proposed reopening the mine to the board of directors, but the board of directors has always said no.
Proposed as in serious?
Yeah.
They think they could economically mine copper, the same stuff.
Yep. And Holden used to maintain a bunch of mine claims around the mine, especially for the purpose of keeping anybody else out. So Holden was in the mining business because they had active mining claims, but the purpose of those was so that no one else could come in and file a claim and start mining right next door. This area has now been totally closed to mining, so that's not an issue anymore. All right, well, thanks for coming down. Thanks for the good questions. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the presentation.